Now this is Channel 2 Right. I'm setting it up for Debbie for Friday, the 1st of September, 72. This is Channel 2 Right, and I'm setting it up for Debbie this Friday, the 1st of September, 72. Channel 2 Right, and I'm setting it up for Debbie for Friday, the 1st of September, 72.
I hear somebody?
And nobody talk?
Well, what do you know? What do you know? Next to nobody.
Come
on in.
I got a boy here in the car. I just took him over and got him a haircut. And I thought I'd say hello while I was in the neighborhood.
Shirley, I just been out, run around. Sit down just a minute. You
okay.
Can watch your boy. I'll watch him.
Okay.
And let me look at you.
Well,
we'll go out there and swap a few cows.
Well, I don't have much time. I left Bonnie and the two younger ones home, and I've got the two biggest ones out there in the car.
Boy, they've been down to Mexico.
Got their hair cut for school. It was either that or braided one. I'm telling you, it's getting
well,
so long.
You know, I'm surprised. It'd probably be easier just to cut it over there at your house.
Well, I like to get it trimmed at the barber's ever so often. I don't do a first-class job of it. So I take them, and being it's the first to school, I thought I'd get it trimmed off right for change.
Yeah. You know, you won't believe this, but I just in there feeling sorry for myself. I thought, well, see, if I had a car, I'd just go over and see what Miss Mary is doing and go over at Shirley's. Faye's got the car, and that, you know, my old Chrysler, the bottom dropped out of it.
Oh.
I was driving that old Chevy.
Yeah.
And the carburetor went bad on it.
Well, for goodness sake.
So he hadn't got that fixed yet. I got him a carburetor, but I couldn't put it on and make it work. So
there you are.
There you are.
Well, why don't you come back with us? Let them pick you up on the way back.
Well.
Can you get in touch with Faye to pick you up over there?
Yeah, she'll be here in a minute.
Oh.
I think I can get that old car over.
Well, no, I've just been so busy all week, and Monday I thought, oh boy, I've got it all done. All I can do is, yeah, just sit and relax. You know, let the kids go to school. I'm going to get the rocking chair and go out there and rock. And no more pink eye. Well, Monday I was saying all this Monday morning at coffee with bourbon before we went to school work, and. I rushed around there and got my house cleaned up for the day. And in popped Helen at about 9:30, I think it was.
Yeah.
Helen and Chet and the two boys.
Well, what do you know?
Not even a phone call. It's not like her, because she usually calls for something.
Yes.
And they'd been to the beach over the weekend, and they stayed, I think, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday night. And then they drove up in the yard Monday morning. Over to the beach, that was. They stayed over there. And so she says, I'm on vacation, Shirley. I said, good for you. You know? Ooh, here I am. I was rigging wet when she came and been down at the barn, working out in the barn and cleaning the house up. And here I was. I was ready for my second breath, you know, so I sat down and had a cup of coffee with her. And I said, good for you. Goody, goody. I'm glad somebody can go on vacation. Well, they stayed for three. Well, they stayed Monday night and Tuesday and Wednesday and left Thursday morning.
Yeah.
So I'm about tuckered out. They ate everything I had in the house. That's those two big kids, you know,
yeah.
The two boys that I kept there for a while.
Yeah.
My God, they can eat. I thought mine were bad, but these boys just don't have a bottom to their stomach. Eat, that's all.
And then when they go change to go somewhere else where it tastes so good.
Well, yeah, they finished two great big roasts. I had to cut them in two because I didn't have a pot big enough to cook them in.
Yeah.
I cooked them. I knew it was foolish just to cook one roast.
Yeah.
So I cooked two. And I was baking a ham before they even got through with the roast for the next day. And doggone if they didn't finish up the roast for supper and had ham sandwiches before they went to bed. Oh, I told Burma, I said, I'm glad they're gone in a way. You can keep something going on that stove all the time.
Yeah.
Well, my kids are bad enough. They eat me out of house and home, but boy, oh boy.
Sure, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. I've had these fellas come out here, you see, in town, and they're so healthy.
I love to see them eat. I love to watch them eat. Well, I don't like to pay for all the groceries.
Fills up the plates and all like that, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, they sit there and they just iron everything, and they just can't seem like they can't stand for something to stay in the bowl.
Yeah, they
and
don't
they,
really need it.
They don't want it.
They don't want it, but they're going to eat it if it's going to. I don't know whether they think I'm going to throw it out or what. But boy, they can eat. I told Berman, I said, I hope you weren't like that when you was a kid. He said, no, because he said it was about 15 or 16 when he really started eating. And he said he never quit. So, but he's not near as bad as they are. I'll just tell you.
You know, you got that hay in, that grass planted at the right time.
Boy, didn't we do something right for a change? I'll tell you, it's so nice to think about that. When I start feeling sorry for myself, I thought, well, boy, you know, all this rainy weather, you can't put up hay, but it's making that grass grow. Berman says, I know how to do it. He said, when I go to cut hay, I'll plant grass.
Yes.
And then when we plant grass, and it'll stop raining, and they won't get more rain on the grass, so we'll get the hay up then. So we've got it made one way or the other.
Well, now, you know, I believe that.
Yeah.
I mean, if there's a cloud coming up, I leave something out to get wet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't fasten everything up.
Well, I'm doing all I can. I've got three loads of clothes on that clothesline for the last 2 weeks. I mean, I've had, you know, I bring them in and dry them in the house and put them out, and I hope that the sun will shine. So he says, well, we need water on that grass, so all I have to do is keep clothes on the clothesline. It'll keep raining.
Yeah. Look, Sarah, what's the name of that grass?
That Coastal Cross.
Yes.
That Coastal Cross. They call it Coastal One is what they call it.
Now, that's supposed to resist the freezing better.
Right, and it's the first grass in the winter. It beats the hay.
Oh, it does.
And I mean, in the spring, first grass up in the spring, and it beats the hay all the heck. It gets up way up like this before the hay even starts growing in the spring.
Gee whiz.
And it's real thick and real heavy, and it bales up very fast.
Yes.
And it grows very rank. In other words, you can put up hay four times a year where you can't put it up but twice at the best off of Pangola. Four times a year you can put
it
up.
That's right.
So it's pretty fast growing grass.
But it's pretty rank. It's pretty heavy?
Yeah.
It's not like...
Heavy like hair on a dog's back. It is thick. It's so thick. The roots just mix and mingle with one another and right down, get right down the ground, and it chokes itself out after a while. If you don't turn it about every 2.5 to 3 years, it'll kill itself because it grows so bad.
Yeah.
And if you don't keep cutting it, if you let it grow rank like this, the roots still keep getting thicker.
Yeah.
And then it'll die out.
Well,
so you got to cut it and keep fertilizing it. And about every 2 to 3 years, if you put up hay four times a year on it, it's supposed to last you 3 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, let me tell you. this bahia, it needs turning every 3 or 4 years.
Right, yeah. I think all grass does.
You tell you what you do. You can fertilize and they'll eat it naturally, especially when it's, you know, when they keep it cut down.
Mm-hmm.
But you plow half of it and let the other go.
Yeah.
And you'll see which one the animals go to.
Yeah.
Of course, it takes another year to get a stand and 2 years to get a better stand. But it's in the meantime, they're eating it all the time.
Well, that's the beauty of this. You can plow it under and 3 months later put up hay off of it. And that's unbelievable, but that's what he does. This fellow over here at Vinkanope, he showed us the field where he had turned it under. With a heavy plow, it turns it deeper than anything we've got.
Because
it's and his tractor is bigger than the one Berman's got. So it really, those discs really get down into the ground. It really plows it. It doesn't disc it. It plows it. And it just turns that sod right upside down. And then in 3 months' time from that, I guess he must go back over it and straight disc it, you know, to chop that in.
Sure.
And to level it up. But in 3 months' time, he goes back and puts hay up off that same field. And that's unbelievable.
Now, that's somebody making
up. Yeah.
How'd you, have you been knowing?
I called him about a bull about 3 years ago, and that man remembered me calling him. And he said, Miss Dottie said, I know you like nice animals, and I don't have anything on the place that you would really want. So I didn't do any business with him. And he has mostly cross cows, Angus and Bramer, and Angus and Bramer and Hereford, and cross breeds. And those cows, you should see them. When they walk, their sides go like this.
Yeah.
Off that grass. So see, he grazes it right along with putting up hay. And I guess he's got several thousand acres out there. He's not in this by himself. He's in it with several other farmers. I don't know, there's one or two other farmers.
You mean several hundred acres?
I guess there must be. It goes on out into that prairie, so there's several thousand acres there, evidently. And they put up, oh gosh, I don't know how many. They've got a huge barn there, and they just stack it full of hay. And they don't sell the first bale, they save it all for the cows. So they've got a lot of cows, a lot of land, a lot of cows, and they have to have a lot of hay.
Well, you know, 640 acres is a mile.
Yeah, they've got,
square mile.
They've got, oh, Lord, I couldn't begin to tell you how much ground they've got there. It's all out of sight. It goes way down to that prairie and way down the road. It's quite a bit, quite a piece.
Yeah. Who's that fella that raises the black cows over there on the edge of the prairie? Don't you know Zeb Trower's daughter? He married Zeb Trower's daughter.
That
men's store in town. But anyhow, they own a whole lot of land over there on that corner.
Well, this is down on, you know where you turn to go to Micanopy off 441 leaving here?
Yeah.
You know, you say you were going into Gainesville. Where you turn to go off to Micanopy. Instead of going to Micanopy, there's another road right across, opposite the road where you turn to Micanopy.
Yeah.
What's the number of that highway there?
I don't know.
There's a service station right on the corner.
Yeah.
And you turn right instead of turning left to go to Micanopy. You turn right. And it's a good piece down that road where he lives.
You mean when you're going to Gainesville?
Yeah, as you're going to Gainesville, instead of turning to go to Micanopy, you would turn right. Because the road goes right there.
You don't mean out toward Rochelle?
Yeah, you'd be going that direction.
And when's that? Outside way?
You know where Mr. Guthrie's buried? You know where the cemetery is where he's buried? He's on that same highway there, but I can't think of the number of that highway or the name of it.
Oh.
About that way.
Oh.
And Sleepy Hollow Farms, that's out there.
Yes.
Mrs. Hollinsworth.
Well, as you go north, is it on the right? Oh, his is on the left.
His is on the left. Yeah.
I don't know where that would be.
Yeah,
it is. I don't know that country.
Oh, there's millionaires lives back in there. I guess all of them are pretty well-to-do. They've got quite a bit of property. And they do things in a bigger way than, on a bigger scale than the average farmer.
Yeah.
But, I guess he's got four or five tractors and he keeps them going all the time. That's farmhands out there.
Berman
saw one of them and I wish he hadn't. That's all I'd heard the last 2-3 weeks. Boy, what a nice tractor that was.
Well, let me tell you, Shirley, how did you get your front steps? Now, they're beautiful.
Berman made those.
How do you get them in ahead of your fence around your swimming pool?
That's what I'd like to know. I don't know. For one thing, he had all the ingredients that he had to have there, all the materials that he had to put into the steps, he had it there.
Yeah.
And he just did this as just an extra added bonus, to the house. But he couldn't put up hay that weight, and we were getting ready. We'd already, this was before we got interested in planting that grass. And really, he didn't have much around there that he had, to do right away. And I'd been wanting those steps, and we'd had some company out on Sunday the following week, and I had fell off that porch. I was coming out, we were having some kind of a refreshment or something for the people. And I missed my step and I fell off that porch. And he told them, and I didn't know it at the time, he told Mr. Colonia, he said, boy, I'm going to build those steps before somebody gets seriously hurt. So the next day he started getting things together, and then in the evenings when he'd come in, he'd lay one step, and then the next evening he'd lay another step until he finally got it all done. So maybe I ought to fall in the swimming pool. That's the worst, trying to get him down there to buy that fence. He knows that they're highway robbery. Yeah. They just charge a ridiculous price for that fence.
Yeah.
And they won't let him put it in. They want to come out and install it themselves.
Yeah.
And make double labor, you know, by charging labor.
Yeah.
So he says, no, he's not going to do that. He's going to wait till he can find some that he can, you know, take down and, you know, pay him for it and then put it up himself.
Surely, of course, he don't want to do shabby jobs. But, you know, you could just put an ordinary fence up there.
That's what I'm going to do. If
and just take it down, you know. It won't have to stay here forever. And
that's
just,
right.
You know, actually, you know, for your purposes, you wouldn't even have to put staples in it. Just hang it on the post.
Yeah, that's right.
Just something to, now, like, I got this cross fence down here where the horses on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So I got some rusted woven wire fence. The barbed wire was already there, and I just hung it over the post.
Mm-hmm.
And but he don't want to do things the way I do.
Well, he had someone he was talking to over at the university. I don't know whether it was Mr. Bennett or who it was. Told him that they were moving a fence. One of these link fence, you know, chain link fence. They had some around some of the buildings over there, and they were going to move it and sell it. So Berman said that he wanted the first chance at it when they sold it. Well, they never have come to an agreement. Well, some of the women that moved in want the fence to stay there into these villages. But Mr. Bennett and several other of the people over there, can't think of his name, but anyhow, they wanted the fence removed so they could build a bit larger building there and use it for a larger span of territory, so that fence would have to come down so they could move all this. And Mr. Bennett said he'd let Berman know as soon as he, you know, wanted it moved so that he could get the fence. Well, that'd be more than three times as much more than we need for that place, but if we get it, I'd go ahead and put it around the yard there, make a dog pen or something too to keep the dogs there when we're not there.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
So,
that would be nice.
Yeah, I'd like to have it, but now to buy that much, it costs us a couple thousand dollars, I guess, to have that much chain like fence around the place.
Yeah. Well, I hate to think how much that fella across from Robert Smith's put into that place.
Oh, my gosh. I told Berman, I said, I'm going to go down there and talk to him. I said, he couldn't have paid the price that they have in town and have all that chain link fence around there.
Well, he's in the hardware business.
Oh, he is. Yeah. Maybe he's getting it at a discount then.
Yes,
he must be.
And he also wants to sell it.
Oh, he is.
But let me tell you, he might just sell it. Let me tell you, he's high.
Yeah.
I tell you where you... did you ever trade with John Palmer? He's out past... the side of Reddy.
Uh-uh.
I'm past Reddy on old 441.
Uh-uh.
He got that country store type place.
Yeah.
Well, he may not carry it, but he can get it. And you can trade with him.
Well, good.
I go down there and buy posts. I buy 20 or 30 times. See, it's all I can
mm-hmm.
call.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a truck. And I say, Mr. Bond, this is God Almighty. He lets me have him for a nickel all for a dime. Something like that. Well, it's just a game of it.
Yeah.
But he'll trade with it.
Yeah.
And he got these water pumps, and he got them right there, half horse, three quarter horse.
What's his? Let me get a piece of paper and
write
his name
down.
Yeah, because I'd like to. We have to have a pump too to go on that swimming pool. You know, you have to have a vacuum to vacuum the dirt from the bottom of the pool while it's filled.
Yeah.
It's a water vacuum.
Yeah.
And we've got all the attachments and the vacuum and everything. All we need is a little small pump, you know, to put on the end of it. Maybe it costs $30, something like that, to vacuum it out. But this has got to be, because you just can't get all that trash out of the pool in there. So many of the kids won't wash their feet. Now, my kids will, but the neighbors are coming down there. The first thing they do is jump right in. They don't wash their feet off, and all that grass goes in the pool.
Yeah.
It just makes me sick. So.
You know, that's I'd forgotten about that, but I remember they used to tell us. I haven't been swimming so long in a swimming pool. You're supposed to take a shower before you go in.
Right.
And then naturally you take one after you come out.
Yeah, right. So they,
if you don't do it, it's hard on the pool.
Yeah. And little Vaughn, now I make them do it if I'm there, but I'm not always right there where I see them when they come up. They come
sure.
up to, the parents let them off down at the end of the laneway, and they walk up to the house.
Yeah.
If I'm at the barn or if I'm busy or something, I don't see them. Into the pool they go the first chance they get.
Yeah.
And if my kids are in there, they don't even, whoopee, you know, and in they go.
Yeah.
But I make them go to the wash shed and take a shower there.
I'm going to tell you, Miss Mary didn't turn her away.
No, and she's pretty sick about it. She called me up. That made me so mad. I'll tell you this. She called me up, let me see, Saturday morning, bright and early, and she said, "Shirley, I'm selling every cow I got off the place." She said, "I'm not going to keep another cow. Marvin's ready to sell them too. He's so mad." I said, "What's the matter?" "I'm so depressed." I said, "Not really." She said, "Yes." She said, "I'm really depressed." She said, "I'm selling every cow." I said, "What's wrong?" She said, "Well, Mr. Hamilton just called me, and she said one of my cows got into his garden and ate his garden all up and trampled it all to pieces. And she said, I just know he's going to sue me." She said, "We're on our way over there now." Well, she couldn't wait till she got the whole story and then called me. She had to go and upset me before she knew what was going to happen. Well, and she went over there, her and Marvin. Well, when she said she was selling every cow she had, I knew of a man that wanted about 25 head, and I wanted to get about 20 more to put out there on that grass. I didn't even care what it was as long as it ate grass, because we had so much of it out there. So, about noontime, I called, and she was home. And I told her, I said, "I'd like to get about 45 or 50 head of cattle from you." And I thought, well, I'd keep some and resell this to this other fella. Then I thought, no, if I sell them, I'm going to charge more for them if I sell them to this fella, because he was willing to pay more for them. And if she found out about it, I'd have an enemy, and I'd rather do that. Rather not do that. So I told her, I said, no. I said, I'd rather have just about maybe 20 head. That's the ones that I was going to keep originally.
That's right.
And then let him go over and do the buy from her.
Yeah.
Although I could have made $50 to $100 maybe a head, because this guy doesn't know how much a cow is from a hole in the ground. So I thought, well, I'd do it that way. Well, she said, and I said, I'll give you top market price for them, because I said, I don't want to have any hard feelings. But I said, if you're selling, I can't find any more that I'd like to put out here. And I told her, I said, all I want would be the Black Angus. I wouldn't want those other Bramer-looking things. So she said, all right. She said, I'll talk it over with Marvin. But she said, you know, I've kind of come to the conclusion I'm going to keep my cows. And I said, I thought she's going to sell them. She said, no, I'm not going to sell them. She said, I'm going to keep them. I think I'm going to keep them. She said, my cow didn't eat his vegetables. She didn't even hurt his garden. She was just looking for a way to get back in the pen, in the yard. And she didn't get out by his house, because she said, Marvin and I put about 6 strands of wire around that fence to her house. Where she got out was way back down on Owens in Illinois, and walked way around and up Faye's driveway and along the road and then back into Hamilton's place, trying to find a way back in.
Yeah.
So she said that I guess he wasn't going to sue her, and she wasn't as upset then as she was earlier. So then she decided she wasn't. Well, meantime, before I even talked with her about buying them, I asked Berman if it would be all right, you know, because I certainly didn't want to do anything without him knowing about it. And he said, well, go ahead and do whatever you want to do. He said, go over and look at them. He said, if you think you can make something on them, he said, go ahead and buy them. Well, I went down the highway, and I went over there and looked at them. This was before I talked to her at noon. Then she didn't know whether she wanted to sell or not. She was going to talk it over with Marvin. Well, I called back again later on in the evening, and I talked to Marvin. And he said he didn't believe much that he wanted to sell any. Believe he's going to hold on to them now, since Hamilton wasn't going to sue him or all this malarkey. So I said, well, Marvin, how much do you think a cow like yours would bring at market? He said, well, I don't know. He said, the top price would be about $200. Good Lord, the skinniest thing I saw went through there would cost about between $230 and $250, and $250. So I thought, well, that was cheap enough, you know, for $200. But he seemed to think it was a pretty good price. So I called around, and evidently the prices are going way down, because there were some more over here in Melrose that was $175 to $200. Heavy springing Black Angus cows.
Oh, really?
And bred by some heavy registered bulls. I don't know.
Well, I thought
I'd wait a while, because I saw in the paper again, I saw where beef prices was going way down.
Yeah.
So I told Berman, I said, no, I'm going to wait. You know, because here it is almost winter time and the prices are bound to go down. So.
Golly, you just don't know what to do.
No, not now. It's too late in the season to be buying at high prices when you can get them for less later on.
I know the boy. He used to live over here. That was talking to about that place.
Uh-huh.
And he had these fellas in Gainesville that had the money. He was just in between.
Uh-huh.
And I saw him once or twice, and I didn't talk to him much, because one didn't think much to say. Except he thought it was practically settled. And then he didn't tell me this, but someone else did. He said the Simon Ranch over here sold, and those fellas were in on that.
Mm-hmm.
So they had dropped, went into Miss Mary's anymore. And I was over there one day, and she seemed greatly pleased to have it off her hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's quite a chunk of money.
Yeah.
And money is pretty hard to come by now. It's just very rarely you run into anyone that's got that type of money. But she works $600 and $700 an acre for it.
Yeah.
And then when she finds a buyer for it for around $500 an acre, she thinks she's selling it too cheap, but somebody else will come along and buy it for more, then she backs out of the deal at least.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't do business with her. I doubt very seriously if I'd ever transact with any cows with her, even if she did want to sell. But I don't want to make an enemy of her, so Berman said the best thing to do is let her sell her cows at market or send them to somebody else.
Yes, that's the best thing.
But it's a shame, because, you know, here, I was willing to give her the top price that they give her at market for.
And they're right across the road.
But she thinks I'm trying to zip her out of something, evidently.
Well,
Marvin
knows cattle, and he knows, he can look at the cow and tell you about what they weigh.
He knew about this. He said that they'd bring $200. And then I called this other fellow over here in Melrose when he said he wasn't going to sell his, and they were selling anywhere from $175 to $200. So. Well, if they're going down even lower than that, and they will this winter, it'd be a better chance this winter.
Shirley, while you're here, there's a friend of yours out here in the lane. He's right here, right here in the lane.
Oh, good.
Let me get my other shoes on.
All right.
Yeah, we'll take one here. The only thing is, if we can jump into something like this, I never can get into my own case. So the best thing is that we've got.
Well?
Yeah.
You see all that foolishness we've been talking. I want to hear them talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got to get to thinking in your language now. Tell me something.
Yeah.
I mean, in your material.
Yeah.
put in my suitcase.
Yeah,
is that a start?
Yeah.
Not very much. You can't go to Europe with very much. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, traveling.
People don't know that. When I went to England, I took a suitcase, and I got to London, and I left the suitcase packed in London and bought a satchel and went with that for the rest of the summer and came back to London and got my suitcase to get on the plane. I left it at the hotel. I wasn't smart enough to do that this time.
No.
I let them talk me out of it, a knapsack.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to take a knapsack. And they told me I couldn't because my dress would get muffed. My dress.
Who knows that?
My mother. I listened to her. So I took a suitcase. But I won't ever take one again. You can't walk with a suitcase. You have to carry it. And it gives you blisters across your hand.
Yeah. I've had some experience with it.
I carried bags too.
But how many did you make him carry? That's what my father says now. He and my mother are going to Europe, and he's telling my mother that she can't take a suitcase. She can't. She wants to take two, and he says she can't do it because he'll have to carry them.
Yeah.
He's taken one this big.
Oh, really?
He's got the right idea.
Yeah.
I don't know. They can't do that.
No extra clothes, trousers, just some.
Some shirts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the art of it, isn't it? Travel life.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not going over there to wear clothes.
No. You don't really need any clothes anyway. For anything. You can wear the same thing all the time.
That's right. You don't go to any occasions.
No. But you need to wear anything. If you have a dress, that's enough. I used to wear blue jeans all the time to school, and they thought that was really funny in France because French people dress very, very well. They're the best dressed people I've ever seen. They just wear beautiful clothes. And I always wore blue jeans to school. And I had a friend who used to say that you know, I was an American. Well, you know, Americans just wear blue jeans. And so they invited me to do something with them, a group of we were going to go have a pizza or something. And I thought, well, I had another pair of pants besides blue jeans. And I thought, well, I won't wear my blue jeans. I won't, you know, I'll look a little more respectable if we're going to go eat a pizza. And I arrived not in my blue jeans, and they were so upset because they had been telling everyone that I always wore blue jeans everywhere I went, and here I came and I wasn't wearing blue jeans, and they were so distressed because they thought I should have come with blue jeans and a Coke bottle in my hand. So after that, I felt fine wearing blue jeans everywhere. I didn't even try.
You know that you saw they had the right attitude toward it.
Mm-hmm. They did. It was a costume.
Yeah, your uniform.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't wear ordinary things.
They dressed really, really well. I just, maybe it's just that the style in this country on campuses is sort of sloppy now. But they really dress well. They'd rather spend money on clothes than on anything else in France. Clothes and food. That's all they spend money on. If they're going to be materialistic about something, they just go buy clothes. And clothes cost a lot over there.
Yeah.
But they know the names of all the fashion designers, like Christian Dior and all that. They know them like they're members of the family. Madame Unal used to tell me, well, this such and such scarf is a such and such. And I'd look blank, and she'd look at me like I had two horns because I didn't know what it was. This poor uncivilized American girl doesn't know what I don't even remember now which house of fashion scarf it was that Monsieur now gave to his daughter when she got married, this really expensive scarf, and the whole family was amazed that he would give this scarf to her because it wasn't Christian Dior, but it was another house like that.
Yeah.
And I'd never heard of it before.
But even Miss you now have a feeling for it.
Mm-hmm. And the little boy did too. The little 4-year-old boy. They took him out to buy summer clothes, and she tried to get him to buy solid colored shorts, and he wouldn't do it. He bought these really loud patterned ones, and then he picked out a shirt to go with them, and he's 4 years old, just inbred.
Yeah. And it had color.
Yes, and pattern. It's blue and white. Bright floral print, blue and white shorts, and then a striped shirt to go along with them. And his mother thought this wasn't such a good idea, and then he dressed up in them, and she decided that it looked all right, so she let him buy them. And he would pick out every morning what he wanted to wear. He'd never let her dress him. He'd pick out what colors he'd want to put on.
4 years
old. By the time he got to be 6, really something.
And there's something about the cut of the clothes that is a little different. Gives it a little air.
Mm-hmm. They wear their clothes. They fit much better than clothes do in America.
Yeah.
I guess maybe a lot of their clothes are tailor-made, but never saw anybody wear clothes like that. And in Italy, the men dress really well, but the women don't dress that well. At least in the cities that you see well-dressed women, but not outside the cities. But in France, even in the smaller towns, people are well dressed. Wine and cheese and fashion.
Well, I can't quite picture you, Debbie. You are well. You look tidy enough. Wearing jeans with all those pretty clothes over there around you.
Well, I just they just didn't suit me. I wanted to wear jeans. I didn't have. You know, I came over with the clothes that I bought in America, and I just wore them. For one thing, I couldn't afford to buy any clothes in France. They cost too much. So I just. You have to have sort of a backlog to wear French clothes. You have to be brought up in it. And I figured I wasn't, so I'd rather watch them, look at them.
Oh, I see. Just try to appreciate their taste,
mm-hmm.
you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well,
instead of doing it.
Yes. Wow, that's nice, a little boy.
His brother wasn't quite like that, though, which was sort of unusual. His brother was 18, and I'd have thought that he'd have been more fashion conscious, like the students that I saw, but he wasn't. He just wore the same thing all the time, except he had a Moroccan coat that he used to wear all the time with a hood, but he loved Morocco. He'd been there.
Oh.
Driving around in the desert, and that's all he could talk about. He used to make us mint tea, it was mint tea that they drink in Morocco in glasses. They don't put it in cups. They pour it through. They put a block. They have a big high teapot like this with a skinny neck, and they put a big block of sugar in it, and then the tea, and then mint, and then you pour boiling water through it, so that the tea and the mint go through the block of sugar down into the teapot. And then you drink that, and you drink it in glasses because the glass holds the heat better than a teacup. And they drink it so hot that in Morocco, anyway, he made it for us, and it was so hot we couldn't drink it. We let it cool. But he said that in Morocco they drink it really hot because apparently if you drink hot things when it's hot, it's better, what he said. I don't know why that is. That's the same reason that you wear a lot of robes in the Sahara Desert. Yeah, stay hot. I'd rather drink something cool.
You mean wear robes out when you're out in the sun?
Mm-hmm. Like the Arabs wear a lot of robes when they ride their camels around because it insulates them from the heat. They don't get as hot. And that is, I guess, the reason that they drink their tea so hot, too. Really.
Well,
boiling.
you've got a view of Morocco and the deserts through the,
mm-hmm. 18. He went there. He talked about it a lot because they ran out of money. So they started catching fish to live. And they'd go around to the villages, and the village people would give them tomatoes and things, and then they'd go catch fish and have dinner and sleep out. And they did that for about a week, and so they thought that they had conquered the world. And indeed, they had conquered a small part of it. And they came back to France. We talked about that a lot.
Lived on the country.
Mm-hmm.
That would make a boy feel independent, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would make anybody feel independent. It would. It was pretty enterprising. When you ran out of money, they didn't come back. They had wanted to stay a month, and they stayed a month even though they ran out of money. They just depended on the generosity of the people in the villages. He said they were very, very generous. They see these starving boys walking into the village, and they give them everything to eat. Open their kitchens to them and feed them.
Uh-huh.
And the peasants, I guess the farmers in the little villages.
Yeah. Well, and they spoke French, I guess.
Yes, yes. They speak French, yes.
Yes, isn't that nice? You can go to Morocco
and speak French.
Yes.
Go to Algeria and speak French, too.
First time I saw a black man, Negro speaking French, it just didn't seem possible.
I had some black friends in Nice too, who spoke French. They were Francophile from Senegal and Martinique. Black girls who spoke French, and that it was surprising the first time. I thought they spoke with a really strong accent too, sort of rolled their R's. Instead of saying back in the back of his throat. And I had another friend who was Canadian, and she spoke Croatian too. She was a Croatian. Her father was a political refugee from Yugoslavia and had come over to Canada. And so she learned English when she was about 10, and then she came to Nice to learn French because she wanted, Canada is a bilingual nation, so she wanted to be able to speak French too. And she spoke She spoke Croatian at home, but English is all, you know, outside of the home all the time. But when she learned French, she learned it not with an English accent, but with a Croatian accent, because I guess Croatian was her first language. She said, roll her R's, like roll like that. And everyone would, when they'd hear her talk, they'd know right away that she was Yugoslav, not, you know, they'd never think that she was spoke English at all. She could understand Russian and all kinds of Slavic languages, but not Serbian, the other language that they speak in Yugoslavia. In Yugoslavia, they two different languages and they can't understand each other. It's amazing to me that they can exist if they don't understand each other, that no effort's made between the Serbs and the Croats, but I guess not.
Debbie, that leaves me blank. But the all along the North African coast, the desert is just a stone's throw back there. So, and the French have lived there for years, so they must have a pretty strong feeling for the desert. Just a sort of a kinship for the desert. Do you,
the French?
Does it come out at all, except in the boy?
No. No, just in the people that go to Africa, I think.
Yeah.
But when they go, when the French people that have gone to Algeria don't, they don't mix with the Algerians. They don't get along, French and the Algerians.
No. Well, at one time they could live in the French European sections. But even so, the desert's going to intrude. If they've got any feeling at all, you know, they'll see those things.
I didn't see it. I saw Mr. Unau used to talk about the difference between the north and the south in France. But that wasn't the desert. That was just more the difference between Mediterranean people. And he was such a gourmet. He said the whole difference was between people who drink beer and people who drink wine. He said that you just never had a civilization where people didn't drink wine, and people were uncivilized and barbaric when they drank beer. That only civilized people drank wine.
Yeah.
You couldn't have a great civilization without it.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was thinking about the Mediterranean civilization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the south of France, he said that there's a line sort of along the Loire where all the wine is produced in the south of France. Although they produce some in the north, Champagne and that. But most of it's in the south. He doesn't, German wines don't count for anything. They're not French.
Mm-hmm. Well, but, I mean, along the Mediterranean, Greece, they had wine.
Italy.
Sure.
Spain.
Sure. Yeah. It's all the Mediterranean, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The old Mediterranean.
You can't grow grapes. But in the north, it's cold.
Yeah.
As easily.
What a difference a couple hundred miles makes, isn't it?
Especially in France. It's so varied. You go 100 miles in France and the whole countryside has changed. It's the most varied country I've ever seen. We went from, just going from Nice up to Marseille and the Camargue, which is a big swamp where the Rhone River comes down. And it's like Florida there, and then in Nice, which is 2 hours away, it's mountains. And if you go up the Rhone River, it's a river valley, and you're up in the Loire Valley, which is another valley, and up around Paris, and then into the north of France in Normandy, it's just flat, green, rolling hills, no mountains at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole country is only the size of the state of Texas.
Gee whiz.
It's small.
Yeah. I never thought of Nice as being back to the mountains.
You stand on the beach and see the snow.
Yeah.
Right along the Riviera. Mm-hmm.
And then the houses went on up into the hill.
Mm-hmm. They had a real problem with land because they couldn't build on the side of the mountain too easily. Land is very, very expensive. And they had built up just about everything. In Monaco, they were just starting to build skyscrapers. But around Nice, they could still build back into the back country a little bit. But people don't really want to live back there because it's pretty inaccessible. The roads aren't very good. Hard to get around. And there's still a lot of little villages back there, little medieval villages that haven't been changed at all since 9th century. They call them perched villages. They just up on top of the rocks. They were for the Knights Templar that came to invade along the Mediterranean coast. And they'd have these villages up on the mountains and light lights to warn each other when there was going to be an invasion. And they're wonderful, fascinating to walk around in. They're just all walled in, and the streets are about maybe as wide as from me to the wall over there. And some of the houses go over the top of the street, and you can cross from house to house. They're all built out of sort of round gray stones that look like they've just been thrown there. And how they've survived for 1,000 years, I don't know, but they're still the same rocks and the same paving. And now some of them have sort of become artist colonies now. People are starting to renovate some of the old houses and move back into them. But one village that we went to, there were only about 25 people living there. It was just a deserted place except for these couple of wood carvers who carved the olive wood. And one lady who ran an antique store, and that's all. Step on top of a mountain. Up out of the olive grove. That's fascinating. olive wood is, you can't cut down an olive tree. It's against the law. The only way they can get olive wood is when they trim the trees every year, when they prune them. And then they save all the little twigs, all the little clippings, and they carve with it. Make really beautiful things. It's beautiful, beautiful wood. That sort of pale gold with black veining in it. And smells like olives.
You smell it. You mean the wood has a color?
Yeah. It's very distinct, the colors between the, I guess it's the veins in the, you know, when you look at a piece of wood and it's got
the
veins,
grain.
The grain is dark, and the wood itself can be sort of gold colored or rosy colored, but it's always lighter than the grain.
Oh.
It's really pretty, but they have trouble because they never have big pieces of wood to work with. They only have little pieces, so they can only make little things. And when they try to make a big bowl from it, a lot of times it cracks. When they'll get halfway through, and it'll crack because there'll be a knot in it, or it'll be where a limb twisted like that, and so it's not strong enough to be made into anything. We went and talked to a man, a wood carver, in his workshop one afternoon, and he told us that. All he can really make is little bowls and flat trays and small things. Because when he tries, he had one great big fruit bowl or something that he was making. It was about this long, and he was about halfway through. And he was so excited because it hadn't broken yet. He said by the time he got through with it, it would probably crack and break. But it hadn't yet. So he was praying over it. So it was...
Well, how come you to go upset then?
Pardon?
What brought you upset?
It was the little village where only 25 people lived. We went because Phoebe wanted to paint them.
Oh, she led the way.
She wanted to paint these little villages, and so we went up just to see them because we'd heard about them, and then she wanted to paint them. So she'd go painting, and I'd just wander around in the villages all day.
Mm-hmm.
And talked to the man who carved olive wood. And I talked to one other lady that afternoon who ran the antique store, and she was telling me how hard it was when they had to do any kind of building or moving or anything, because the streets were narrow, and the streets were steep, and there was no way to get anything in to move. Like, she had a lot of really big pieces of furniture in the antique store, and she said that she had a very hard time getting them up there because they had to bring them on donkeys.
Uh-huh.
And so it really raised the cost, I guess.
Yes, I can imagine.
They tried to do. And construction, too, was the same way. They had to bring bags of cement on the back of the donkeys.
Mm-hmm. That's all you needed was somebody like Phoebe. You didn't have to do a thing, did you? Just talk.
Just follow her around.
Just
follow her around. Watch her paint. That's a good thing to do, be a painter. People stop and ask you about your painting. She didn't like it when they did, mostly, because a lot of times they'd bother her.
Yeah.
But she'd just be sitting down outdoors. She paints outdoors always. Or almost always, except when she's doing courses.
But it gave you a chance.
Gave me a chance to go out and go into all the villages. We saw all of them all around me. About, I don't know, 10, 12 little villages. St. Paul and Rockburn and Pay and Payon and Saint-Agnes. All these wonderful. And they all looked alike too. I mean, to look at them, they had all been built in the same period and in the same way. The little winding streets, and all enclosed in a wall.
Yeah. Right on top of the mountain.
Mhm. They look just like they're part of the mountain coming up, you look up and there's all this rock, and then suddenly you realize that it's the wall of a town, and that there's this little town with the houses all piled on top of each other, sitting up on top of the mountain. Like a little hat. That's great.
That would take some leveling just to get the things to hold together, wouldn't it?
And it's amazing how they ever built them in the first place.
Yeah. And they go way back to the Crusades.
Mm-hmm. Even before the Middle Ages. They're very old. Ninth century, 10th century.
Really? I never saw anything that went that far back.
You know, it's so hard to think of that they're that old, but things were even before the Middle Ages, before all the Gothic were, these things were there.
Yeah.
And that they're so untouched now, that they haven't been destroyed, or
yeah.
Because most people aren't interested in them, I think. There are one or two that have been made sort of little tourist towns, and people go to them, but most of them are just forgotten about, except for a few people who go up to live in them, because it's a hard living. That's why people don't want to go there, I guess. No water, and hard
right.
Heat, and
yes.
All that.
How would they get electricity up there?
Yeah, run extra power lines.
You'd have to have some electricity, wouldn't you?
They do. I don't know if you'd have to, but they do. They run electricity up now.
Yeah.
And water and all that.
Well, you could use a battery radio. Keep in touch with the news. Now, this little castle or chateau or house that you, where the terrapins were, or the turtles, that wasn't way up. That was just
no, that
on
was
a
just
back
a
street.
Nice. That was just a back street in Nice.
Yeah.
That was wonderful. That was a, I guess it had been built around, it's sort of Victorian, but it was Greek Victorian.
Yeah.
It had columns and it was white. It was called the Villa Blanche, the white house, the white villa. And it was so disreputable. That was what was so wonderful about it. It had fallen into such disrepair, and it had this beautiful old formal garden that nobody had taken care of in about 30 years. And so you had to look really hard to see all the little paved walks that used to be there, and then just all these tropical plants that were tumbling down on top of each other. I've never seen so many different kinds of blooming plants, and every time I'd go, there'd be something else would be blooming. It'd be roses one week, and little yellow flowers another week, and she had strawberries growing one time, and she kept turtles in the garden. That was the best part.
Yeah.
She had African and Greek tortoises, big ones like this, and she raised baby turtles. She had about 15 baby turtles that she kept.
But it took a long time for them to get to be big turtles.
It took a long time. Her turtles were about, well, they were about this big, I guess. And she'd had them about 10 years, maybe.
Big as a saucer?
A little bigger than a saucer, really.
Yeah.
But the little turtles would just stay about the size of a little bigger than a silver dollar for a year or more. The one that I had was really tiny, and all it ate was lettuce. Easiest pet in the world to have.
Just ate lettuce.
You didn't have to give it water. You didn't have to do anything except give it lettuce every day, because it would get water out of the lettuce. And then they turn them loose in the garden, and they eat the garden. They eat grass, and you turn them loose.
Yeah.
But they make the last time I went out, her turtles had just had laid eggs for a year, and so she built these little cages all around the egg mounds. I guess they dig it, they make a nest and lay the eggs, and then cover them up and make a sort of little mound, and the eggs have to sit there and hibernate for 6 months maybe, and then they hatch through the winter, and they hatch the next year.
Yeah.
And so she had to mark the place so that no one would walk on
them. Oh.
And they were digging up the plants or something.
David, were they able to keep the house in shape inside?
I didn't go inside. I just saw the garden.
Yeah.
The outside was surely disreputable, and I don't know what the inside was like.
Yeah.
Never asking him.
Yeah. Well, I want to be sure they asked me.
I couldn't walk in. I'll bet I know somebody that would. I bet I do too. I'm not here for a thing. Just want to see your house. Can you do it? Oh, I should have walked in.
Well, next time you go, Miss Smith, she'll invite you.
I've not seen Mrs. Rice. Mrs. Rice.
Yeah.
Was a little short English lady with curly gray hair, and she was very, very frugal person. I guess that was the first thing that struck me about her. She never wasted anything, and she I'd watch her eat her breakfast, and she'd take some butter, and she'd take some honey. And she'd eat a piece of bread, and then there'd be just a little bit of butter left. And so she'd eat some more so that she didn't waste the butter. And that for me was just epitomized Mrs. Rice and her frugal nature. And sometimes I'd be home from school in the afternoon, and she'd want to fix tea, and we'd both be there, and we'd both want a cup of tea. But she wouldn't want to fix the tea until everybody came home, because she didn't want to have to fix tea twice, because she'd waste tea. And so we'd both wait for everybody to come home. And one day, I guess I must have looked really thirsty, because she broke down and she fixed tea before everybody got back. And we had our tea. And they didn't come back till almost 6:30, so it was a good thing that we had our tea.
And it did waste tea?
Yeah, it wasted tea, because if you made one pot of tea, you might not finish it with two people, so you have to make about four cups of tea for it to be a good pot of tea.
Oh, I see.
And you might not drink it all. And then by the time somebody else came back to drink it, it would have steeped too long.
Yeah.
And you can't drink tea that's steeped too long, because then it's bitter. She was a connoisseur of tea, the one you see now is a connoisseur of wine, and she taught me how to make tea. You have to boil the water, and you take the tea kettle to the teapot. No, you take the teapot to the tea kettle. You don't take the tea kettle to the teapot.
Oh.
Because the water's got to be boiling when you pour it into the pot. And if you take it off the fire and you take it over to the teapot, it'll stop boiling.
Yeah.
It's a fine point. She told me that.
Yeah.
And you have to be sure to make enough tea, so there are enough leaves in there to steep a while. And you don't want to let it steep too long. You only steep it about 5 minutes, 3 to 5 minutes, let it steep. If you let it steep too long, it gets bitter and you don't want to drink it.
Yeah.
And dilute it with hot water after you pour it into the cup.
Oh, yeah, it's got a taste.
Mm-hmm. Unless you like it hot, really strong.
You like it strong?
Yes, I like it strong. I never wanted to dilute mine. I like it with milk, too. I could never drink tea with milk until I went to England. And now I don't like it any other way. Yeah. I go around adopting habits.
Yeah.
I'm very bad that way.
It seems so right there. Sometimes mm-hmm. it doesn't seem quite as right when you're away from the country.
Mm-hmm.
But she's the one that gardened with you.
Yes, oh, she loved to garden. That was what she would do all day, was garden.
Yeah.
She worked in the garden. She said that every Englishwoman loved her garden and loved her roses. And that was why her daughter liked to garden so much, because her daughter was English. And if she'd been a French woman, she wouldn't have liked to garden that much.
But she did keep up the garden, even though she lived in France.
Yes.
Her daughter.
Yes. She loved to garden too. She told me that there was nothing she liked better than to go out and dig for a while. She'd rather dig in the earth than do anything else.
Yeah.
And she'd mow the lawn too all the time. She used to mow the lawn. Well, she mowed it every week. And I thought that was excessive, but I've never mowed lawns, so I don't know. Maybe you have to mow lawns if you mow them every week. But she always mowed the lawn on Friday because she didn't want her husband to have to mow it on the weekend. So she'd mow the lawn. She'd kill herself mowing the lawn every Friday so that when he came home Friday night, he would see that she had cut the lawn and he wouldn't have to cut the lawn over the weekend. That was her final service for the week. Cut the lawn.
Well, now, was there more like our mowers?
Mm-hmm.
Power mowers?
It was a power mower, except that it had trouble with its blades and it used to get clogged with grass.
Well, the grass was that thick.
Oh, yes. It was fine grass. It wasn't the kind of grass that we have in Florida. It was like, name that real fine grass that some people have.
Zoysia.
That's it.
Like they put on a golf course putting green.
Yes. There's real fine grass like that.
Yeah.
They use those mowers that spin around?
Mm-hmm.
A rotary?
Mm-hmm, a rotary. And this fine grass would get all caught up in the rotary mower. And so she'd have to stop every now and then and turn the motor upside down and get all the grass out. And then all the oil would run out. The motor was always breaking down.
Yeah.
It was the bane of her existence every Friday.
Yeah.
Get out with that.
Yeah. And she didn't get any help from the 18-year-old?
No. He wasn't much good for anything around the house. He was supposed to be studying all the time, but he didn't. He didn't like it, and he didn't study. So he wanted to be an actor, and that was all he could think about, really, was going on stage. He didn't want to be a medical student. His family told him he should be. They have they think that all people, all kids should be able to do something when they get out of school in France. And a lot of kids don't go to sort of professional schools. That's what Dinal's daughter did. She went to a tourism school, to learn how to be a travel agent because.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because she could speak English already. She spoke English and French, and you had to have two languages to get into the school. And then you learned a third language in the school, and you learned how to fill out tickets and do things like that. But it was mostly just learning languages because tourism is such a big business in Europe. There's so many tourist agencies everywhere you go, and you have to be able to speak a lot of languages.
Yeah.
So that's what she did, and is working in a tourist agency in London now. And so they decided that Vincent should be a doctor, and he didn't like it. I don't think he's going to be back next year. I don't think he passed his exams. But I don't know yet. They haven't written to me. Are you guys or not?
The cost of just living over there, isn't it? How'd you figure how much it would cost you just to live?
Well, I didn't really figure it. I just went over with a lump sum of money, and I had all my meals with them. Well, I would have lunch at the school, and that cost 30 cents at the cafeteria. And then I just paid them for the room and for my meals, and I used to pay about. Well, the buses cost a lot. I used to pay about 40 cents a day to ride the bus. That was a lot. I'd take the bus
and that.
Yeah.
It's
not
up over a week.
20 cents each way, I think. And that's about all you had to spend money on, except, well, I bought a lot of books. Well, not a lot, but I bought books. And we used to ration ourselves to coffees because coffee was really expensive. We'd go around and price the coffee in all the cafes all around school. We spent a week pricing coffee, and then we'd go to one place where it would be cheaper. But that was really all I ever spent money on.
Because you had your entertainment.
Mm-hmm. I didn't need to do anything like that. I went to a couple of movies. But the trouble was that they were mostly American movies dubbed in French. And I hate to see dubbed movies in the first place. I don't like to see somebody talking. And
I don't either.
And speaking another language and their mouth is working. Their mouth is not caught up with their words. It unnerves me to watch movies like that.
It unnerves me too.
But I saw a documentary on Algeria that was pretty good.
Hey?
But your fee at the Unals was not exorbitant.
No, it was $100 a month for everything. So that wasn't very much, really.
That's a room and board.
Mm-hmm.
It's not bad at all.
No.
Yeah, you better go back over there and live well.
And then you see you were learning all the time with him.
Mm-hmm.
You should have paid them double.
I know.
That's the way they are. But they're used to that. I mean, they're conditioned to it. They expect that, don't they?
expect what?
You learn.
Mm-hmm. You are. Let's see now, Liz. Thought I should speak flawless French. He had a complex because he didn't think that he didn't really think that I should be in the house because his wife spoke English, because, you know, she was English. And he told me that. He said that he didn't think that that was really where I should be because there was an English influence.
Well, but she didn't speak much English to you.
No. Mrs. Rice did, though. She wouldn't speak French to me. She said it tired her to speak French. She wouldn't do it. Mostly because she wanted Jean-Pierre to speak English. So
yeah.
Made him listen to her in English.
How about that?
The French grandparents never learned English.
Huh?
The French side of the family never learned English. The French grandparents never learned English.
Yeah.
There you go. I wonder if English grandparents did, though.
Debbie, what is it? What is it you like about it? It's hard to say, isn't it?
It is hard to say. I like, I really like the more leisurely pace. The things weren't so hurried.
Yeah.
It was restful. Not to always be rushing around.
Yeah.
And it really had been rushing around for the year before that. And I come back and I'm rushing around again. Seems like you can't slow down over here.
Yeah.
But see, they worked so long. Well, Mr. Unal did. They didn't have time to do anything else except sit and talk, really.
Yeah.
Which was nice. They didn't have long evenings or anything. They just had the dinner table every day.
Yeah.
So they had to talk.
Yeah.
And they had enough things to talk about.
Yeah, they talked. Yeah, they talked about what they've been doing. And well, sometimes if we'd watch the news or something on television, we'd talk about that. I remember the day that George Wallace got shot. We didn't hear about it till the next day. And they were pretty horrified by it, so was I. And then I felt sick all day. And I thought I was going to be sick to my stomach all day long. Because it's just so horrifying to me that it was still going on. And they couldn't understand it. They just sort of walked around saying, violent country that you live in, this violent country that you live in. And there wasn't anything I could say, nothing, because I felt exactly the same way they did about it.
Yeah.
Nothing I could say.
But Debbie, you felt different when you went to other parts of France. You felt that southern France is not really France.
I felt that Nice wasn't really France, because there were a lot of people there who weren't French. There were a lot of Italian people there, but that's fine. But there were just so many people there on vacation, sort of, and that wasn't really France. But the little village that I visited in Normandy I felt that was really more French than more what you think of as being French. So all the little fat Norman men with their little fat red noses because they drink brandy all day long. And they all drive big, huge Belgian horses, and all farmers. And the village was like the village in Corsica. It was a crossroads, and that's all. And my friend taught in the village school. She taught the elementary, the first four grades, I think, of the elementary school. And then there was another teacher who taught up until they were ready to go to Lycée. And these little kids walked to the school from all around the village. Some of them walked as much as 2 or 3 miles in every day, little 6 and 7 year old kids, to go to school. And the school, and she lived over the school. They had made an apartment on the top floor for her and her husband. And then the next door was the mayor's office, the mayory. And then there was one store and one cafe and a church and a couple of houses, and that's all that was in the village. And everybody knew everybody. She took me on a tour of the village one morning, and we walked down each of the four rows and of the crossroads, and she knew everyone that we met, and everybody stopped, and I would meet them. I was the American friend visiting from America, and I'd get to meet them, and they'd all want us to come back later in the day. And one lady invited us in and gave us some Duvenet, I think, or some aperitif to drink, and she wanted us to stay for lunch. And you see, there people just immediately invited us in, because it was just a little village. It was a crossroads. That's all it was, and everybody knew everybody, and they accepted me as a foreigner because I was part of Marie Claude's family, sort of, since I was visiting her.
Well, did you go to lunch with them?
No, because we had to go back and have lunch with Julianne. He was coming home from work.
Yeah.
Had to go back and put food on the table. And we didn't have lunch with them.
That would have been a nice place to stay for a while.
Yes, I think so. That would have been really nice. That was near Mont Saint-Michel. They could see Mont Saint-Michel when they drove 4 miles away or got up on a hill to see it.
Yeah.
That might be like our friend said, when I asked what would he do, and where would he go? He said he knew in the apple tree in Normandy that he would stand it.
Yes. And in the south of France, they laugh about the people in Normandy. They think that they have all these jokes about the Normans, because they say that they're such gluttons. They have these big feasts, and then they drink Calvados, which is apple brandy they make from the Norman apples. And they drink Calvados between each course so that they can get more food down. This is disgusting, but apparently true. But I thought they're charming, charming people. Very nice.
Well, Debbie, but you didn't go in and eat with them.
Not that day, no.
Was it the people with the red nose?
No, that lady didn't have red nose. That lady, the red nose belonged to the, actually, it was, there was a farmer who came by driving his big horse, and he had a very red nose. And Reclo told me that was the Calvados he'd been drinking already that
Did
morning.
Did he with him?
No, he didn't ask us to. He just drove right by.
Well, I was just stopping and telling him you wanted to go home with him. Could you understand them?
Yep. Everything.
You go along. Let me go along with you. You be the interpreter, and I'll go in and eat.
You'll walk in.
Ricky said you got to put out a wash.
You know what? You can, like that, you see, you can just go out with your friends, you see, and you'll be right there in the middle of the street, and you'll have the whole village around you and just be talking, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's everybody's well acquainted.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sit down on the stoop and talk to any of them. Wouldn't that be nice?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, I never learned that. I didn't know that. I couldn't talk to them.
I think I'm in love with that little place myself.
She had, my friend had a servant, though. She had one of the farmer's wives used to come in and do her housekeeping for her because she taught school all day and she didn't have time to cook or anything like that. And she said, tell me she didn't like it anyway, and she didn't want to have to do it. So she got this woman to come in, and they were really good friends. And the woman used to take her food across the street to cook it because the stove was bigger across the street. One day we had lamb chops that were cooked across the street, and Marie came. Irene, and she'd come running across the street carrying our chops on a plate and run up the stairs and put them on the table and then leave again.
Well, isn't that nice?
Because his stove was bigger.
Her stove was bigger and better. It was a wood stove, so the taste would be
better.
How
long did you stay there,
Debbie? About 5 days.
Well, Lord help us, you're a Saturday. What else did you do there?
Well, they wanted me to see all the things that the Americans had done in World War II.
Oh, hell. Why didn't you stay in the village?
They thought that I had come all this way and that it was very, very important that I see what America had done for France. And there wasn't too much I could do. They took me to see the beaches where the armies landed on D-Day.
Isn't that awful?
I thought it was, well, I wasn't
and you left
too
that
enchanted
nice
with
village.
It. Mm-hmm. I went to see the beaches.
Wow.
And I was so stupid. We were going to see these beaches where the armies had come, and they said that the beaches were Utah Beach and something else. And I didn't even know what Utah was. They asked me what it was. They said, well, what is it? It must be an American word. And I said, well, I don't know. Maybe it's a code name that they made up. And finally, I saw the sign, and I realized it was Utah. And the other one was Omaha.
Yeah.
I was really stupid. So I told them what it was then, but I just didn't understand the French pronunciation of Utah Beach.
Well, did they belong to the village themselves?
Yes, they did. Except, well, they had a lot of friends, and the next town over was a little bit bigger, and they had a lot of friends there. But they knew the village really well, and they liked it. They didn't ever want to live anywhere else.
Did
but
they talk about it?
Yeah, they said that after there was a ritual after church on Sunday that. Everybody that had been to church would go into the cafe. There was just the one cafe in town.
Yeah.
So they'd all file into the cafe and sit down at these long tables, long wooden tables, and they all sit and have coffee and brandy after church.
Nice.
After they get the religion down. The whole village, or everyone that went to church, they didn't, Marie Claude and Julian didn't go to church. So they'd watch it because they were right across from the church. The the school and the government office and the church were all right together. Those being central points of the town.
Well, you see, now that's they have what we have left behind, you see. They had the school and the everything right there in the community.
Mm-hmm. They were so proud because their church had a window that had been classified by the Beaux-Arts in Paris. And that was the first thing they told me. Their little church had this window in class.
Yeah. Now, did they have any shops or anything there?
No, they had a store that sold stamps and it sold some food, a little bit of canned food, and it sold clothes and shoes. It was a country store. It had everything in it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We went over and bought stamps one day, and then just sort of looked around and met the woman there.
Yeah.
And
she had to say?
She didn't have too much to say. She had thin lips.
She worked for the government. Government people didn't talk.
She didn't work for the government. She just sold stamps.
Yeah.
But she didn't talk to us very much. But we looked around. We looked at the... I thought it was just amazing that they had shoes and everything in there, too.
Yeah. All that stuff just on shelves?
Yeah. Just piled on the shelves. The shoes and little dresses and shirts. And a little bit of food. And it was a tiny room. It was about half the size of this kitchen. Tiny.
Oh.
Yeah, and she kept the stamps. She had the stamps in a great big old black notebook.
Yes.
And sort of had to fish around to find them.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought 10 stamps, and that was more stamps I think than she'd sold in about a month. And she just looked at me like I was really a strange person that I bought that many stamps. And I thought maybe I should have gone back once an hour for 10 hours and bought one stamp at a time.
Yeah.
Not to make it so hard for her.
she didn't sell foreign stamps. Well, you didn't use foreign stamps.
No, French stamps.
Yeah.
Couldn't use foreign stamps. Couldn't. Had to weigh everything in France, too.
Oh, do they?
Mm-hmm. They're really stingy about their postal service. You weigh your letters, you weigh your postcards.
Weigh the postcards.
In Corsica, they weighed the postcards. They also do it differently in every post office. They charge you differently everywhere. I was sure, sometimes I'd mail letters, and between the strikes and having them mailed, I was and having them weighed before they were mailed, I was never sure whether they ever got out of the post office or not. But sometimes I'd go in and I'd just ask them because I knew how much I'd paid the time before, so I'd say, just give me a stamp for a franc 10, and they would, and I'd just send it off and wouldn't think about it. And then other times I'd think, well, this is a heavy letter, I better let them weigh it, and they'd weigh it, and it would be something entirely different than the stamp I had bought the day before for a letter. So I guess they all came through.
She knows a lot about that religious faith.
Yeah. I speak a lot of religious too.
Yeah. I just love Sea Village. You see, I didn't have enough sense when I was there to look at a village. I'd walk down the street and think I'd seen the village. You see, that was, isn't that awful? You think the simple one would know better than that.
Didn't stay in a village in Germany, though. Darmstadt was a big town.
Yeah. They turned the light on so we could see which...
Yeah. Well, it's so much fun to take a trip.
Yeah.
Without having to get on the ship.
Yes, sir, the reporting is so much more satisfying than the experience.
He always looks down when he says that.
That cost me. That information cost me. They had been out making syrup, and I had just been sort of pulled into it, just to be cooperative. That's a very sinful thing to do, is to be cooperative. And the way it worked out, I went with the Van Arnhem out to Gertrude's out there. Well, Gertrude Dammer wouldn't talk.